A deadly shooting on Fountain Square just days after Cincinnati officials announced the city's summer safety plan. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, the latest on that case and a look at crime data this year. Plus, where do Cincinnati public schools rank on Ohio's new vaccination rate dashboard? And flock cameras in Newport? Why residents are concerned. Joining me now to get our news review started is Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Thanks for being here, Cameron.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this fatal shooting on Fountain Square. What happened?
So the shooting happened on May 8th, which was like last Friday. And police say that it was a conflict between two men over a common girlfriend, as they didn't expound on the details of the relationships with all of them, but 36-year-old Christopher Shipman fired three shots at Darius Wheeler, according to police. Shipman has been charged with murder. And his attorney is claiming that he fired in self-defense. The police are claiming that Wheeler was shot in the back.
What do you know about the victim?
Wheeler was an employee at the at City Bird, which is a restaurant there on Fountain Square. Beyond that, there has not been a ton of information that has come out about, the ins and outs of everything. The detective in charge of the case, David Gregory, did say that Wheeler initiated a physical confrontation. Again, a little bit of police speak there. It's a little unclear what the details of that are. And that he also said that Shipman, the man accused of firing the shots, didn't eat at the West restaurant, but had waited for Wheeler to come out of the restaurant to kind of engage with him, I guess.
Well, what does the data show about shootings in the city this year so far and crime overall?
So overall crime in the city, which would include all kinds of serious offenses, non-serious, like minor crimes, misdemeanors, all overall crime is down about 1% year to date over last year. Violent crime specifically is up about 3.5%. So no drastic shifts there. In the downtown area specifically, which last year was the nexus of a lot of discussion about what police were doing and arguably led to the dismissal of our police chief, Teresa Thigi, who has now been, there's an interim who has stepped in to fill that role. But overall crime in downtown is down about 8.5% versus the same period last year, like this early, winter months into spring time. So I guess there has been some movement in downtown. I would say that 1% and 3.5% are kind of a negligible difference, not really anything I would get too excited about. But 8.5% is a more serious change.
Yeah. You mentioned former police chief Teresa Thigi, and I seem to recall there was a shooting on Fountain Square last year, I think in October, that became an issue in the discussions surrounding the former chief and her leadership and putting her on leave. Is that right?
Yeah, so there was a shooting in the more or less the exact same area. I believe the people involved in that shooting were at the same restaurant, City Bird. And they were, the shooting happened on Fountain Square right there. Anything that happens on Fountain Square is kind of notable for the whole city. And that shooting was just like a week or so before they decided to put Chief Thigi on leave, on administrative leave, while they conducted this investigation that would go on for the next several months before they finally decided to let her go, I believe just a month or so ago.
So have any city officials made any statements about police presence or public safety on Fountain Square after last week's fatal shooting?
There have been. Mayor Puerval came out and said that it was, it's an unacceptable tragedy that thousands of innocent residents use the square every day. So, yeah, I mean, there's been an outcry of trying to get in front of all of this kind of violent events. That's been a continuous kind of refrain from public officials. They are really doing, I think they're at least publicly saying they're doing everything they can to kind of do everything they can get all of this stuff under control and also kind of get in front of this with more police visibility and things like that.
Well, as I mentioned, that shooting happened just days after Cincinnati city officials had a news conference to explain their summer safety plan. Is this year's plan any different from what they did last year?
Well, so they do these press conferences every year, these announcements, and they are, there's two sides to these announcements each year. One side of it is all of the great things they're going to do for kids over the summer, the pools, the rec centers, all of that, which obviously has ties to, you know, violence reduction, and it keeps kids off the street. It keeps them, gives them safe places to go. And then on the other side of this press conference, which again happens almost every year around the same time, they do announce their policing strategy for the summer as well. And in terms of the policing strategy this year, Interim Chief Adam Henney outlined that he would be expanding bike patrols. Again, that plays into the idea that there needs to be a lot more visibility. Bike patrols are pretty popular downtown. They've always sort of had a bike patrol unit that operated around those areas. And then he also is doubling the number of officers in the vice unit. And the vice unit, people might think of that as, people might have something in their mind about what a vice unit is, like they go after like prostitution or things like that. But one of the particular duties of the vice unit in Cincinnati is looking at liquor establishments. And there were a few shootings in the past year that were high profile that kind of stemmed out of liquor establishments and bars. And there's also been complaints in the public about like certain bars being kind of spots that were trouble kind of brews. So they are going to be looking into those places where they think there might be problems and trying to crack down on those places.
Will the police be working with the courts in any new ways? I know that was something that former police chief Thigee raised concerns about last year.
Yeah, so Henney did not discuss anything directly about Thigee. Like he didn't throw any stones in that direction. He honestly said he wasn't going to talk about her at the press conference when asked directly. But what he did say was that that he wants the department to be looking internally instead of pointing fingers at other people when it comes to public safety. So he said that that he was going to be working with his own department to better support the other areas of the judicial system and the criminal justice system. There was a lot of talk last year about the revolving door of justice, as it's called, and judges setting low bonds for people and that kind of creating a continuation of a crime. Henney said what he was going to do was he was going to have more officers in initial hearings so that judges have all the information and the full story about what they're accusing this person of. And he also said that he was trying to work with his officers to provide more information on arrest reports so that, in theory, the judges will have a lot more information in order to set a proper bond.
Well, I believe it was the same day of that shooting on Fountain Square, a woman in Lockland was killed. Tell us about that case. What happened there?
So we don't have a lot of verified information from police on this investigation, But we were told by people who knew her that she was an office manager at a auto business in Lockland, and that there was an attempted robbery and of apparently around $1,500. She pursued, her name, I won't try to pronounce her full first name, but, her nicknames are, Bukola and Bucky. They call her, people call her both of those. And her last name is, Pieria. And she was working, had been working at this place for a while she was getting her master's, her MBA at Xavier University. And, when this guy took off with the money, she kind of went after him a little bit and tried to pursue him. And I guess he turned and shot her, according to the people who knew her and were kind of familiar with this business. And she died. She was 30 years old. She was born in Nigeria, and she was sort of sponsored to come here by a man named James Michael Lafferty, who was at one point an executive for P&G. But when he met Pieria, he was working as the CEO for Coca-Cola in West Africa. And he's a big fitness guy, a big athlete. He's been a coach for his entire career. And he would organize these races in Lagos, Nigeria with kids to like give them a chance to run and maybe earn a prize or something. He did it with the mayor of Lagos. It was sort of a community outreach effort. And that's where he met Bucky. And she was such a talented runner that he really took notice of her. He befriended her family, and he kind of arranged for her to come to America and study here and get an education. And she's already earned a master's degree. And the master's degree she was working on at Xavier University, she was due to graduate this Saturday. Yeah. So tomorrow.
So sad.
Yeah, so that would have been her second master's degree.
Yeah.
And it's just been really, for the people who knew her, it's been really heartbreaking. She was a faithful Christian. She had a Facebook account that was just post after post of her singing gospel music and religious songs. And it's been, for Lafferty in particular, who I was able to interview, he's really heartbroken by what happened.
Well, and she was still very active in terms of running locally, wasn't she?
Yeah, she had competed in the 5K. I get I'm not a runner, but she competed in the 5K race for the Flying Pig, and almost it seemed like she competed almost every year. And she came in first in 2024, and then she placed in the top five last year. So yeah, she was definitely still running.
Wow. And this friend of hers you interviewed, if I remember this from your article correctly, he called her the picture of the American dream. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Lafferty said that it was that she came here. She worked hard. She had hopes of being an Olympian, but he said that they had a lot of talks about that and how it's almost like a lottery getting into the Olympics. So he really encouraged her to focus on her studies, and she did. She was a very, very good student. When she got here, she was a top student in Nigeria as well. But when she got here, she still had a lot to kind of catch up on. So she went to community college, and then she went and got her bachelor's degree. She got her first master's degree. She got her second master's degree. Xavier University confirmed that she was planning to re-enroll in the fall for a business analytics degree as well. So she was working hard, and for him, that was his vision of the American dream, that you can come here and you can work hard and you can succeed.
Well, Cameron, I want to ask you about another policing issue. What happened with this Cincinnati police dog that bit a local teenager?
So it's a story that came out that had come out last fall, but it happened last spring. And there was a 16-year-old boy. He claims that he was asleep in his bed, and he had an open warrant for an EMU violation, which is like an EMU is the ankle monitor that is placed when you're on, like you've been accused of something. They're not going to hold you in jail, but they're going to put you on an ankle monitor to keep track of you and make sure you stay out of trouble. And he had apparently or was accused of violating that that ankle monitor. He was not where he was supposed to be at the time. So they issued a warrant like they do. That's the kind of standard procedure. You know, you violate, they issue a warrant. And his attorney was expecting this to be handled in court because they already knew he had violated, but they already knew he was back where he was supposed to be. So it was a violation. They needed to address it, but it was going to get handled in court. At least that's what his attorney thought. Instead, the Cincinnati Police Department went to his home and they started calling in to get everyone out of the house. And a lot of people did come out of the house. And then at a certain point, they realized they still had not gotten this particular kid out of the house yet. So they walked up to the door with a police dog and they started shouting in, "I'm going to release this dog. If you don't come out, you got to come out," everything else. Eventually, after a lot of warnings, they send the dog into the house, and almost immediately, within a minute, the dog finds the boy and latches onto his arm and bites him. And then the police bring him out. They kind of have to struggle to get the dog off of him, and then they bring him out of the house. And this whole time, his mother is apparently on the way to the house. So she was en route. She knew the police were there, that they were going to pick her son up, and she was trying to rush there to get to him. The body camera shows that she does arrive pretty quickly after and is like, "What happened?" And he claims that he had fallen asleep and it didn't hear them yelling for him, which the police obviously dispute. And the question was, why did all this happen over a nonviolent? It was a motor vehicle theft that was the original initiating charge for all of this. But why? That was the question the family had. Why all of this for this kid who did, you know, hadn't been accused of shooting anybody? There was no violence. There's no violent convictions. What's the deal?
Sure. And wouldn't the police have gone in themselves? I mean, is it how common is it for them to send a dog in rather than go in themselves?
So and those are the questions that I posed to the police department, and they had an explanation. They said, we had seen a photo of him on social media, this teen, they'd seen a photo of him on social media holding a gun. And that's what prompted the kind of elevated response. They claim that that they use dogs to find people when they don't know how else to find them. And they say that it's a safer way to do it for both the officers involved who don't want to be ambushed or anything, and for the people involved, because if it were to become a conflict, you know, a high stress situation, an escalated situation, the police, you know, they have tasers and they have guns, whereas a dog bite is arguably less severe than a gunshot wound. Yeah. So what I did was I also wanted to look and see how many times police dogs were biting people and kind of how they measured that. I wanted to understand that better. And it turns out that there had been in 2024, there had been about 12 people bitten by police dogs in Cincinnati. And in 2025, that number was 11. So around that number seems like kind of the baseline for what is common. I had about 3 years of data. And then they track it via this thing called bite ratio, which is like a ratio of how many people are bitten versus how many people are found. The interesting thing is I did find that the kind of the definition and math of that has kind of changed over the years. And it appears that like right after the federal consent decree in 2001, after the civil unrest here in the city, that the definition of that was a little bit stricter, and they really narrowed it down to canine apprehensions versus people found during canine deployments. And that might have some effect on the numbers, but the family has filed a CCA complaint, a Citizens Complaint Authority complaint, and the complaint authority is investigating this incident to kind of see if everything was done by the book. The investigation that occurred, every dog bite is investigated internally in the police department, and in this case, the investigators, the people who reviewed everything, found that it was within. It was all within policy. So there was no discipline taken against anyone after this. But It was interesting because we don't have too many dog incidents involving, you know, force with dogs in Cincinnati. So it was, it's not something that makes headlines a lot. So I did want to find out just how frequently this was happening.
Right. I would urge our listeners to check out your story to get it. You get into a lot more detail. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Thank you so much for your time today, Cameron. Up next, school vaccine rates are out. Where does CPS rank? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The Ohio Department of Health has a new dashboard that lists kindergarten vaccination rates statewide. So where do Cincinnati public schools rank? Joining me now to explain is Cincinnati Enquirer, education reporter, Grace Tucker. Welcome back, Grace.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Always great to have you here. So tell us about this dashboard. What's the idea behind it?
Yeah, so this data has always existed. School districts are required to report their vaccination records for all students every year by October 15th is the deadline. So the data itself is not new, but the way it's packaged is new. So the Department of Health put together this dashboard, which really clearly ranks counties as well as individual schools on their vaccination rates to just increase transparency around vaccines. You know, Ohio has had a number of new measles cases this year. So this is something that I think a lot of health officials are thinking about. And in looking through the dashboard, I very quickly found a stark contrast in Hamilton County's vaccination rates versus the rest of the state.
Well, tell us about that, especially for Cincinnati Public Schools.
Yes. So essentially what I was seeing is that a number, easily over a dozen of Cincinnati Public Schools had really high rates of students missing vaccination documentation, which means they might be in the process of getting vaccinated, but as far as the school is concerned, they have not reached their full vaccination status, which for a number of vaccines is essential. You know, you are required to have multiple doses. So we were seeing that at Kilgore School, Taft Elementary, a handful of CPS schools, the students, there were very low rates of students that were fully vaccinated. But then when we looked at another urban district like Columbus City Schools, the great majority of students were completely vaccinated, up to 80%, 90% of students.
And when you say very low rates for CPS, how low is that?
We were seeing less than 10% of students being fully vaccinated. I believe there is even one school where there were zero students that had complete vaccination status. And it's important to distinguish that this is vaccination, this is documentation of vaccination. Mm-hmm. So if there were 0% of students recorded as being fully vaccinated, that might mean that that is a reporting issue and the school failed to report or couldn't get the documentation in time to show that there were X amount of students that had a complete slate of vaccines.
Is that what Cincinnati Public Schools says happened? I mean, how do they explain this data?
They essentially, yes, they said they believe that the data in the dashboard is not reflective or accurate of the reality. They believe more students than the 10% or whatever percentage it showed on the dashboard are vaccinated or in the process of getting their vaccines. And I spoke with the school board president, Brandon Craig, and he said he actually thinks the dashboard needs to be improved and that it needs to be updatable. So throughout the school year, he believes districts should have the opportunity to go in and update those numbers so that, you know, even if there are a small amount of kids who are fully vaccinated by the state deadline, October 15th, if there are, you know, more complete rounds of vaccinations and you have more parents who are kind of completing that for their kids, then that can be updated and reflected in the dashboard.
Mm-hmm. So aren't there state laws in Ohio requiring kindergarten students to be vaccinated? And what does the law say about kids who aren't vaccinated attending school?
Yes. So under Ohio law, kindergartners have to be vaccinated. Oh, also this dashboard looks specifically at kindergartners. And the state law dictates that kindergartners need to be vaccinated against a host of diseases like measles, mumps, polio, chickenpox, et cetera. However, there is no stipulation requiring districts to mandate those vaccines in any particular way. So it's really up to the districts if they do want to require that. CPS does not have a district policy that requires any certain vaccinations. Actually, the only district policy that exists around vaccines is one requiring employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. So the other sort of nuance here is there is a law that says that unvaccinated students cannot attend more than 14 days of school without a written exemption saying that they're exempt for a medical or non-medical reason or documentation that they're in the process of getting vaccinated.
So is it that the Cincinnati Public School District just isn't enforcing that rule very strictly?
Correct.
And why wouldn't they be?
I'm not sure. I mean, the bottom line is there is no entity enforcing that state law. So there is no clear indication that they are going to be penalized for not following that law. Columbus City Schools follows it very strictly. I spoke with their director of health, and she said on the 15th day, they are contacting parents and pulling kids out of school saying, you know, you either need to get your child fully vaccinated or you need to get, physical documentation saying that they're exempt for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And CPS does not enforce that. And the reason they gave me is involving chronic absenteeism. They're saying they're already dealing with high rates of kids who are chronically absent from schools, so they don't want to, increase that by pulling kids out of school under the, the discretion of the law.
Mm-hmm. Do local public health officials have any concerns about these rates that you found on the dashboard?
Yes, I spoke with a couple, the Hamilton County health officials, as well as City of Cincinnati's Department of Health, and the word they used was they were puzzled by the numbers coming out of CPS. So there definitely is a confusion there, or maybe a lack of understanding, but they essentially are concerned in the hypothetical of an outbreak having these high rates of students in Cincinnati public schools who don't have documentation of being vaccinated would really complicate any sort of effort of these county health departments having to go in and confirm kids' vaccination statuses, which is how it would occur in the normal procedure of an outbreak.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know Cincinnati Public Schools has health centers in a bunch of their schools. Are they helpful when it comes to providing vaccinations for kids and families?
Yes. The several district officials I spoke to really doubled down on the health centers. Those are in partnership with the City of Cincinnati's health department as well as Cincinnati Children's. They are great resources for families. They can often provide services for low cost or even no cost, including immunizations. So they are there. But whether the district is mandating or requiring parents to go to those health centers, I don't believe they are. I think it's really up to each parent's discretion.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get more information about if parents want to know about their specific school, if they're in another district and they want to see those rates, where do you go get that information?
Yes, so that's all available on the dashboard, which is posted on the Ohio Department of Health's website. But the dashboard is a little tricky to navigate in that it lists each school's vaccination rate, so you can't really look at a district from a, aggregate. So shameless plug, you can go to cincinnati.com. I put together a searchable table that is free. So go to that article. It's free and you can search up your district and it'll immediately show you the vaccination rate for your district at large.
Terrific. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter Grace Tucker. Thank you so much for your time today, Grace.
Thanks.
Up next, Newport has flock cameras all over the city. I bet you can guess what neighbors think. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We started today's program talking about policing and public safety in the city of Cincinnati. Now let's talk about law enforcement in other parts of the region. Joining me in this recorded interview to do that are WBXU Northern Kentucky reporter Danny Villarreal Martinez, and Kendall Crawford, a reporter for the Ohio Newsroom. Welcome back, Kendall and Danny.
Hi, happy
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Great to have you both here. Danny, I want to start with you. Newport, Kentucky is one of the latest communities in the region to begin using flock cameras. Remind us what these cameras do.
Yeah, definitely. And they're definitely the latest They've been popping up everywhere. So Flock cameras use an automated license plate recognition system. So basically, they will snap a picture of your car, of your license plate specifically, as you drive by. And it, you know, gets that detail. You can see the make, model, and it records what time and what place the picture was taken. And it does that automatically for every car.
How many of those cameras have been installed in Newport, and where are they generally located?
Yeah, so there's 34 in Newport right now, which is a high number, and that's because they were doing like this free trial sort of thing. And they're near highway exits. They're in commercial neighborhoods like bars, restaurants, and residential neighborhoods too.
Huh. What do city officials say they want to use this information for?
Yeah, so city officials, really, it seems like they really wanted to have these cameras, especially when they kept referring to abductions as a way to like use these cameras. So if there's a crime like that where they have to act fast, they can, and they get a witness saying like, this is what the car looked like, they can quickly go and search through what they've taken, the pictures that were taken recently, and just really narrow down. And they say that's the only thing they're using these specific cameras for. They do have a bunch of other cameras for like traffic and like ticketing and all that, but these cameras specifically are only for that. So they'd only be pulling in information when they're trying to like, when they're doing an investigation and there's an active case.
Okay. What concerns have Newport residents expressed about these cameras?
Yeah. So some residents were surprised to see the cameras installed in residential neighborhoods, like I mentioned. And the big concern is that Flock cameras are from Flock Safety. So that's like a third-party company. They're also for-profit. So residents are concerned that their data is being stored through that third company, so not just Newport. So technically, you know, Flock Safety has access to whatever pictures are taken and all that data.
Mm, what did city officials have to say about that concern?
They said, well, they're using this technology because the police chief said that they weren't able to develop good enough cameras to do what they, like the Flock cameras do. They say that, you know, there's no concern. There's like contracts, there's kind of laws and policies in place. But from their side, you know, they say they're not just going to pull this data freely. They can only do it if they have an active case number going. So they have to put in a case number. Only like authorized individuals from Newport can look this up. And yeah, that they were trying to like mitigate all those concerns.
Did that seem to satisfy the residents who were worried about this?
Not too much. I spoke with some residents afterwards. They were still concerned about, you know, data, and because it gets uploaded to this cloud system. And even though officials did say the cameras themselves, it's not like they hold the data there. So if someone were to hack a camera, they would only see the camera, like they would only be able to control the camera, not the data, because the data gets stored into a cloud, all that techie side information. But, you know, yeah, residents are still concerned that that information can be accessed by, for example, some residents brought up immigration enforcement, that if they were to come in and ask the city, you know, we have an active investigation, we need this information, it would include the Flock Safety cameras.
How much would it cost the city? You mentioned they've been doing this on a free trial. How much would it cost the city of Newport to continue to use these if they decide to go ahead with that? And where would they get the money to do it?
Yeah, so the chief said it would be $3,000 a year per camera. So right now, it seems like they want to aim for 6 to 8 cameras in this first year. So that would be like $18,000 to $24,000 a year. And that would come from forfeiture money. So basically money that they get from, you know, drug bust or other like illegal, like recovering illegal materials that they turn into the federal government. But then sometimes they get to keep whatever money reward was taken from that.
Yeah. What, when will the city decide whether or not to do that? And did you get a sense for whether, you know, the city commissioners and mayor were supportive of this whole idea?
Yeah. So there is no contract yet. So that's something that people are confused about. There's not even a contract drafted yet,
okay,
according to city officials. This was kind of part of a, this was part of the Board of Commissions meeting. They talked of the police just giving a report on all the technology they use. So they didn't only talk about Flock cameras, but there's no contract yet. And they said that they would hold another public hearing once there is a contract drafted, and the city manager will have to like turn it in to the city manager to like review and approve. And I got the sense, you know, all of them spoke and they all kind of started with like, we were hesitant to, but then we learned about the cameras and about what they can do. Major Gadouli specifically said it seems really important to be able to, you know, the side of like pulling data fast, especially in what he called like a golden hour in an investigation where, for example, again, abductions, they talked a lot about that. When someone gets abducted, that first hour is the most important and is the most critical for finding them. So being able to use this camera. So they seem very in favor. And if there was a contract soon, I think it's very likely.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information. I appreciate it. Kendall, I want to turn to you. You looked into rural Ohio police departments that have entered into partnerships with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. How many departments have done that in Ohio?
Yeah, when you look at these small rural police departments, it's 10 that have signed voluntary 28-7G task force model agreements. And so these memorandums of agreement basically allow rural police officers to aid in enforcing in federal immigration law. In my reporting, I focused on those municipal, like small agreements, but there are other 28-7G partnerships. So a lot of several counties in Ohio have signed these agreements, county sheriffs. And then a recent report from the ACLU actually found that there are partnerships across 17 counties. So 10 of these municipal ones, but it's also multiplied on the county and statewide level.
Okay. Tell us more about the kind of agreements these police departments have with ICE and what kinds of things those agreements allow them to do.
Yeah. So essentially, they kind of deputize police officers and allow them to enforce certain bits of federal immigration, which they wouldn't have been able to without these agreements. I looked at one rural county's rural police department's partnership in Adams County. It's not too far from here. And they have two police officers. It's Peebles Police Department. And basically what those officers are allowed to do are to interrogate any person believed to not have citizenship. They're allowed to arrest those without citizenship on a traffic stop. And they're allowed to detain and transport arrested people to detention facilities for ICE. But there are certain limits. There's a whole different things that they can checkmark on the agreement that they're allowed to do. So there are cases when they maybe are able to carry out federal arrest warrants or ask a jail to hold someone for extra time. But in Peebles particular case, that wasn't checkmarked. So
okay. So they kind of agree up front, this is what we can do, this is what we won't do, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So it can vary from department to department, but in some of the contracts, it's outlined very clearly about this is what your department part of the federal immigration law that you're allowed specifically to kind of take over on behalf of ICE.
Well, we've talked before on this show about the Gratis Police Department visiting several Cincinnati public schools, apparently on behalf of ICE. What have you learned about that department's agreement with ICE?
Yeah, I mean, because of that move in which they were working outside of their jurisdiction, the program has been suspended. Zach Carrion from WVXU reported on it. He reported on one officer resigning and then the chief being placed on administrative leave. So it seems like some of the controversy that has come out of that agreement has already kind of had, you know, village officials talking about investigations and essentially kind of tabling the matter for now.
Hmm. How have other rural departments been enforcing federal immigration law so far?
Yeah, it's been interesting because I expected to learn about other, you know, departments doing sort of these types of arrests and how it's been working for them. But I spoke with a couple of police chiefs and they told me that, you know, they signed up for these programs. In some cases, they got trained for these programs, but they just essentially don't have the people to carry it out. I spoke with one department, Aberdeen and Brown County, and he told me over email that he didn't even get around to the training because all of his officers left and he's the only one there now. So that's kind of limited his ability to enforce federal immigration law when he's obviously in charge of this whole area by himself. There's also the case of Pleasantville and Fairfield County. Their police force disbanded entirely, so it's probably safe to say that that police force isn't doing much with ICE right now. And then there's also been instances in which the chiefs that sign these agreements, they are placed on leave. So in the case of Gratis, Brian Perry, who is the police chief of Sardinia and Russellville, and those are both villages that have these agreements, he was placed on administrative leave alongside his entire staff in Sardinia in late March. He's currently being investigated for misconduct, including racial profiling. So when you take all that and you look at all these departments, it's around half of them that the people that initiated these agreements are no longer there and able to kind of participate.
Hmm. Well, I know you wrote there was a federal push last fall to get more police departments to assist ICE. What does ICE offer these rural departments?
Yeah, there is like a lot of financial incentives that they were kind of pushing on the federal level. So they can get $7,500 for equipment per trained officer. They can get $100,000 for new vehicles. And then they're also advertising that like full salaries and benefits could be reimbursed for participating officers. And so we have seen some reporting in New Hampshire, for example, where there's been entire rural departments whose salaries are paid by ICE because they are participating in these agreements.
So are Ohio police departments getting that kind of money? Are they getting paid a lot by the federal government for all this?
Yes, that's kind of still unclear. I mean, I filed open records requests for all of these departments, financial records with ICE. I'm still waiting on some, but several have responded saying, since they're not actually doing that much work for ICE, they haven't got paid. I mean, that doesn't mean they won't be paid in the future if their participation increases. There, of course, are the departments that have not responded yet that potentially could be getting paid. But as far as I've been able to find in my reporting so far, even departments like Gratis have said, like, we have gotten nothing yet from ICE.
Well, what can you tell us about the number of undocumented immigrants who even live in these areas?
Yeah, that's interesting. If you look at the population, because these are all small villages, like I mentioned, if you combine them all together, it's around 12,000 people total. And then I looked at Brown County's population estimates from the Census Bureau. Four of these agreements are in Brown County. And the 2020 census estimates that the foreign-born population, which doesn't just include people without undocumented status, it includes green card holders and naturalized citizens, that estimate of the foreign-born population's at less than 1% for that county, which is around 44,000 residents. So, I mean, if you do the math there, there's probably not a lot, but still these departments are signing up.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Danny, I want to talk to you about one more issue. It's not law enforcement, but I know it's been a hot topic in Northern Kentucky, and that's the Dixie Highway. I'm going to use the term road diet. I know that you talk to people who don't like that term, but some Northern Kentucky communities have concerns about this plan to reconfigure Dixie Highway between Erlanger and Florence. Remind us what this plan called for.
Yeah, so it was changing that portion of Dixie Highway. So there's a total of 4 lanes, 2 going south, 2 going north. And they want to change it to a total of 3 lanes. So 1 permanent turn lane in the middle. And so for left turns and 1 going each way. So total of 3.
Okay. And why does the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet want to do that? What's their reasoning behind all that?
Yeah. The big thing is safety. They said they found that for a corridor, that's what they call the portion of road like that, in the state, you know, this specific one has double the rate of accidents than is expected for similar roads, similar portion of roads like this. So they're just very much wanting to get that number down.
The state paused this project earlier this year. Why'd they do that?
Yeah, so there was just a big public outcry. It started, honestly, with like City of Erlanger officials taking onto Facebook, specifically the mayor of Erlanger, excuse me, Jessica Fett. And they kind of said, you know, we weren't made aware of this project. We found out by accident. And she said up front, I don't agree with this and I don't think it's a good idea.
So was there much notice for elected officials or residents or for this whole thing? Yeah.
So KYTC has said they did admit, no, we didn't give notice because for this type of project, they technically don't have to since they weren't using any like federal or state money. And they said the city of Erlanger, you know, then told the other two cities that are affected that they found out through a contractor. So no one from KYTC told them.
Okay. Well, do you think this could change the way the state asks for public feedback on projects, even if it's just what they call a maintenance project and not a bigger project?
Yeah, that was definitely the big question I had too. And talking with specifically the chief engineer, Bob Yeager, he was very surprised at the reaction. And he said, you know, yes, I think in the future, we have to consider more than just the money, like where it's coming from. But like he said specifically, are people going to see a change in their community? So like this road, it would be a big change visually and like how people drive. So things like that definitely, hopefully will influence according to Bob Yeager.
Yeah. What have you been hearing from residents and public officials more recently? This was, I think it was back in February when the project was paused and it was real. There was a lot of hot heat surrounding this whole discussion. Are people now convinced this is a good idea? Are they still skeptical?
Yeah, so there's definitely a good, I would say, three sides to it. Those saying yes, those saying no, and those that don't really care. Because there's obviously people that, you know, are very indifferent. But there's definitely more people that are for it now than before. Now that the information is a bit more clear, a lot of them are for safer walking streets, they say, and like just in support of, you know, a road diet. As you said, like it balances like who can use the road better, like cars, pedestrians, bicycles, and buses, not just cars. But the people that still say no are still very firm on that. And that is still a significant amount of people based on these meetings that I went to. And, you know, they've had some of their concerns addressed, but there's still a big concern of the side streets, which are used to like alleviate traffic. Like people will just kind of speed down these residential side streets. And that's something that KYTC hasn't been able to address yet.
Well, what's the next step with all this? And is there a time frame for when KYTC will make a decision?
Yeah. So right now, after wrapping up public input period, they said that they're just going to go through everything. They were giving out these surveys during the meetings, asking for feedback. So they said they're just going to go through all that, see what they can do, and hopefully have a solution or just a decision done by the end of the year, they said. So we'll see. There's nothing set yet.
Okay. Well, stay tuned. I've been talking with Kendall Crawford, a reporter for the Ohio Newsroom, and WVXU Northern Kentucky reporter Danny Villarreal Martinez. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.